My name's Mike Mentin. I'm a research fellow at Swansea University, working on the Disability and Industrial Society project. And today my talk is called Leisure, Play and Sport for Disabled and Deaf Children in the 19th and Early 20th Centuries. And it's going to be a talk about looking at the history of special education and really trying to get into some of the issues that sport history can tell us. So when you think about the history of special education, the history of blind schools, deaf schools, schools of physically disabled children, you mostly think of timetables like this. You get up at 7 in the morning, or you get a nice little lie until 7:15 in the winter, you have morning prayer, breakfast, you have dinner, you have lessons from 1:30 to 2, and then there's a half an hour break in the middle of the day for recreation and preparation for afternoon school. It's not something that you can generally think of as having much room for any kind of fun whatsoever, let alone leisure or sport. But I like to think that if you look closer at regimes like this, then leisure, play and sport was an important part of disabled and deaf children's educational routines. With history like this, it's hard to find the children's own reactions to what they were doing. But if we look closer at sources from institutional records, then we can get a good impression and some details of what was offered to them and how they might have reacted to these sport education they were given. So to do this, I'm going to look at two main case studies and two schools from my research. The first one is the Chailey Heritage Craft School in East Sussex, which is still in operation, having started in 1903 as the first institution for physically disabled children. And the second, a bit more locally, is the Cambrian Institution for the Deaf and Dumb in Swansea, which started in Aberystwyth in 1847, with the intention of it being central to Wales, moved to Swansea 3 years later in 1850, when they realised that Aberystwyth may be in the centre, but it's pretty damn hard to get to, and some things don't really change. So it moved to Swansea and was demolished in 1995, having been used for various other reasons since World War II. So using the East Sussex Record Office and the Westbourne Morgan Archives and the records of these schools available, I want to show that the place of sport and play, from reports of sports to mentions of playtime in school minute books, become visible and help us get into a few aspects of disability history which are rarely looked at. So to start with the first case study, the Chailey Heritage Craft Schools. This was founded in the late 19th century by Grace Kimmins, a London-based philanthropist, as the first school for physically disabled children. It emerged from an organisation called the Guild of the Brave Poor Things. This was set up by Kimmins as well as a meeting group and a social group for disabled people within communities, both adults and children. And although it has incredibly outdated terminology, so it would probably be considered quite offensive now, the Guild of the Brave Poor Things was nonetheless a way for disabled people to get together and have social groups. So we see on the picture on the left, it's a red membership card featuring their logo, which is a crutch crossed with a sword, and the motto of the Guild of the Brave Poor Things, Latus Sorte Mea, happy in my lot, in Latin. And that appears on the picture on the right as well, drawing of a boy with a crutch, which appeared on their annual reports. Grace Kimmins, when she set up Chailey, wanted to use a similar set of imagery, militaristic ideas, when she set up Chailey. She wanted to make a school that disabled children would be proud to attend. And by doing this, much like she did in the best possible spirits of the Guild of the Brave Poor Things, she used a very melodramatic way of discussing it. At one point, the school referred to itself as the Harrow and Eton of Crippledom. But most importantly, Kimmins and the Chailey School saw play and nature as essential for disabled children's upbringing, and contrasted it with the urban dinginess of the children's homes. It came from her background, not just in the Guild of the Brave Poor Things, but also an organisation called the Guild of Play, which was at the forefront of the play movement for working class children in urban neighbourhoods. The historian Kevin Vahoney has written about the open air play movement and how it aimed to be a socially civilising influence on children. And this is seen in contemporary open air schools such as that at Bostall Wood in Plumstead in London. You can see that in the photo here, which shows a teacher teaching children in deck chairs outside in a sort of woody surroundings of the school. It was intended to bring some fresh air and some open air and play into the children's lives. And the open air movement gained quite a lot of traction in educational circles and then fell out of favour when they realised that they were living in Britain. And you can see these ideals in Chailey. Grace Kimmins wrote in 1948, looking back on the school's ethos, that the only one satisfactory solution to the question of how best to help them, 2 or 3 years in pure air, with good food, living under healthy surroundings, this may permanently heal some and will strengthen others. So we see this idea of healing disabled children through play and through outdoor environments. And physical education became an important part of the curriculum in the Chailey School. We see here, much like many other mainstream schools of the time, a drill routine being used in gendered classes. You have the girls at the top and the boys at the bottom. With the girls' class at the top, you can see most of the institution's female staff looking over them as they do a routine. And then on the bottom, with the boys, you can see the boys were variously in crutches or having their crutches on the floor, and this is being looked over by a quite hard to see on the screen, but there's a man in military regalia clearly going for a sort of military spirit with this drill, continuing the kind of militaristic ideas in the names like the Guild of the Brave Poor Things and their description of themselves as a great army of suffering ones. But it wasn't just this education that was part of their physical education. It wasn't just these classes. Education, sports, and educational ideology went hand in hand. An event in 1905 called a School Speech Day in Sports shows just how important it was to their public image as well as their educational ideology. It was a major event promoted to the public and attended by Princess Louise, the Duchess of Argyll. According to the programme that we found in the East Sussex Record Office, the speech day would begin at 1:55 when Princess Louise boards a train at Victoria Station. When she arrived at the school at 3:45, the boys would form a guard of honour and sing the national anthem, as well as a poem called The Definition of a Gentleman by Cardinal Newman. And then the sports would begin. There'd be athletic sports in the playing field, a gymnastic display in the open-air gymnasium, and some more fun-sounding sports like sack race, wheelbarrow race, and a 90-yards obstacle race. It's been pointed out that it says 30 years horse and rider race should be 30 yards. and the quotation on the programme at the bottom showed that religious imagery, as well as military and sports, came into this as well. To make some nook of God's creation a little fruitfuler, better, more worthy of God, to make some human hearts a little wiser, manfuler, happier, more blessed, less accursed. It is a work for God. So we see this religious imagery implying that it's an affliction and almost a curse that can be cured by sports and by open air and by exercise. The example here shows the importance of sport to the Chailey School, and especially to its public image. But we must remember that things like this were an exceptional event. Historians need to look a little bit deeper for more everyday instances of sport and leisure. And this is possible with some of the extensive work I did in the archives for Cambrian Institution for the Deaf and Dumb in Swansea. Again, this is Wales' first school for deaf children, founded in Aberystwyth. And its curriculum was a mixture of signed lessons, articulation and oral lessons, and I'll talk a little bit later about the immense divide and ideological battle between those two. And gradually, more subjects as well. Like a lot of schools at the time, especially the criticised ones in Wales with the 1847 Blue Books, the criticism of Welsh schools, the Cameron Institution originally focused on the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, but gradually added more subjects. By 1888, the report included language, writing, and articulation, but also geography, general information, sacred history, religion, and indeed gymnastics. A programme of physical education was eventually laid out for, by the school, and by 1905, they built their own custom gymnasium outside the school building. And we see that here, a separate brick building housing enough room for gymnastics lessons. And in the photo, you can see people studying outside it. And this was a space for gymnastics lessons. Turn off the lights so you can see it a bit better. This is a space for gymnastics lessons, which again, like Chailey, were gendered. In the bottom left corner, you can see a lesson with the boys being photographed all in their positions, but with a male instructor, also with a boy kind of almost floating on the bars there. With a, you can't really see it in the photo, but he has an expression on his face which says along the lines of, "When am I going to get let down from here?" And then a girls' lesson on the right in 1904, printed in the same annual report. It's gymnastics, not sword fighting, as I first thought it was. You can see that there's a gymnastics display going on, it's being looked over, much like the Chailey photo, by an assistant teacher, a female assistant teacher. There. So as you can see, there's gendered gymnastics lessons, and it's forming an important part of their curriculum. But sport was more than just a lesson or a necessity. It brought respite from school life. It was also a method of charity. In a document that the school prepared called Hints to the Benevolent in 1892, the school recommended potential philanthropists buying the children a football or a cricket set to amuse them. Football clearly meant a lot to the pupils as a part of what leisure they could salvage from their timetables. Children were allowed to play football games on the field. They checked the scores in the local newspapers that were delivered free to the school. And the boys' compositions in the annual reports sometimes mentioned the boys having a bit of a kickabout to amuse themselves. But more than this, it speaks further to the role of football in the deaf community. Martin Atherton, David Russell, and Graham Turner write in 1999 in an article for The Sports Historian that not only has football been a popular sporting pastime, it's also played a major part in maintaining and strengthening the social and cultural ties which bind members of the deaf community together. This is true right from the beginnings of deaf schools in the 19th century. For example, the earliest deaf football clubs were connected to local deaf institutions. The Glasgow Deaf and Dumb Football Club was formed in 1871 from players and people associated with the local deaf institution, and predated both Rangers and Celtic football teams. And you can see in the photo here, the York Deaf and Dumb Mission Football Club, connected to the local mission, a religious mission, and with strong ties to the local school. You can see the team getting ready for their next season in the photo, with a number of other players and some children behind, which may or may not be deaf children coming to watch the game. Reports of deaf football games were all over 1890s deaf newspapers. These are a fantastic source for the deaf historian because they are by and for deaf people. They show some of the debates within the deaf community itself. And it spoke to contemporary debates within the community of the suitability of sign language versus oralism. And this is a debate emerging in the 18th century and all the way through the 19th in deaf education about whether signs are appropriate, sign language, or oralism, which vowed to take away sign language and supposedly teach deaf children to speak and integrate more within the hearing community. And so there was this big ideological battle between the two. And the British Deaf Mute, a deaf newspaper at the time, used football sometimes to discuss this very sensitive political question. In 1895, they reprinted an American story of a football game between Gallaudet College, which is still going, first university specifically for deaf people, and Mount Airy football team, whose deaf players mostly came from the oral department. And they used this American reprint to discuss some of these issues. In the piece, they said that the oral team was pretty comprehensively trounced by the manual team, by the sign team. It said, the ignorance of the rules of the game shown by the oral team, we can attribute to nothing but the difficulty of explaining them orally to the players. Their poor teamwork was due to their absurd signalling, which sometimes took so long that the umpire ordered them to play ball. The editor of the British Deaf Mute, the British newspaper, said that we reprint this story in full. It will amuse our manualist friends, the ones that use sign language, and give our pure oralist readers food for thought. And so clearly this football game acted as something of a metaphor and a political statement to the then current and still current debate between speech and signs. But for the pupils of the Cambrian Institution for the Deaf and Dumb, sports were equally complex. They were closely monitored by the school as potential gateways to immoral paths. When the pupils were invited to play a football game against a group from Bristol, the headmaster denied them this and sent them quite pessimistic responses to the challenges. They said that the school has no club, they mostly play rugby anyway, and it was simply impossible. But even more unacceptable was their invitation to an athletics meeting to be held in Bolton for deaf people. This is meant for the adult deaf in the district, but schools sent delegations featuring both adult deaf people connected to the school and past pupils, and some older pupils as well. The principal of the Cambrian Institution was angry at the invitation for each gentleman to bring a female companion. Principal Benjamin Payne of the Cambrian Institution wrote back to this invitation saying, I entirely disapprove of one particular, which is the special invitation to each gentleman visitor to Bolton to bring at least one female with him. The rules of society forbid females unaccompanied by a mother or a person qualified to take the mother's place to travel with a gentleman. Getting quite a tense and terse response from the organiser of the meeting, the principal then wrote back saying, I do not object to sports. We both agree that a deaf gentleman ought no more than a hearing gentleman to travel with one lady who is not his wife or daughter. And this shows the fear of the school of what might happen should the meeting go ahead, suggesting perhaps some flares of flirtation going on, that the athletics meeting wasn't quite all it seemed on the surface, so clearly some worries about that. But it possibly speaks to something more sinister, the eugenic debate at the time about deafness being passed on hereditarily. It perhaps suggests that male and female deaf people at the athletics meeting shouldn't be mixing. But that's one interpretation we can get from this. What's really clear here is that sports were morally surveyed by the school, and although they were seen as important for education, it was also a potential bad spot, and they required looking over by the school. So to bring these examples together, these few examples that I've chosen from the history of special education, sports were a way of bringing disability and deaf communities together and were part of a changing concept of special education in the 19th century. But as we've seen with the Cambrian Institution, they could be restricted and moralised about as well. We've seen examples of sport and exercise and physical education used both to justify certain educational ideologies as an essential part of the curriculum and as a potential moral danger. I think there's more to this as well. And I think historians in the future of special education need to look at leisure, at recreation, at sport, to uncover parts of special education history that have remained undocumented so far. Thank you very much.